In the final years of the reign of James I, Kenelm Digby was insulted by an ambassador to the English court, who railed against him bitterly, calling him the son of a traitor and the husband of a whore. Digby responded with a threatening growl. He told the ambassador that, quote, he now looked on him as a public person and that he had nothing to say to him, but that when he was himself, he would travel all the world to cut his throat. These menacing words clearly seemed sincere. Seeing Digby's frightful countenance, the ambassador, quote, begged King James to make his peace with him. The traitor father to whom this ambassador referred was Everard Digby, one of the executed gunpowder plotters. The wife was Venetia Stanley, later described in characteristically gossipy fashion by John Aubrey as that celebrated beauty and courtesan. Like Aubrey's account, however, this anecdote that I've just read to you was written down many years after it occurred. It appears in an extraordinary document in an unbound manuscript in the British Library, comprised of three sheets on which are written 22 anecdotes relating to the royalist group in Paris, apparently written down on April the 30th, 1659. No less than six of the 22 relate to Digby, ranging from salacious gossip to his experimental evidence for the atomistic hypothesis. Viewed in this way from the vantage point of the late 1650s, Digby's life had been defined in part by his shifting response to the ambassador's double insult, and particularly his ambivalent relationship with his father's Catholic faith. He had undertaken a daring Mediterranean voyage in 1628, intending to defend his reputation as a patriot and a royal servant, and he had taken communion in the English Church soon after his return. In 1635, however, 2 years after Venetia's untimely death, he publicly proclaimed his reconversion to the religion into which he had been born. Digby's initial conversion was reported by the Venetian ambassador on December the 27th, 1630. There had been talk of sending an ordinary ambassador to Spain, he wrote, and I'm quoting his letter now, and many mentioned the name of Sir Kenelm Digby, who was at one time a pirate in the Mediterranean and who let your serenity's subjects feel the unlawful effects of his robberies. Moved by ambition, he has recently abandoned the Catholic faith and become a Protestant. We should not be too quick, though, to assume that Digby's conversion was merely superficial and calculated because it lasted less than 5 years. The circumstances surrounding his conversion and reconversion, like many aspects of his life and work, have never received the attention that they deserve, and the ambassador's appraisal has largely been accepted. When Gardiner, in his History of England, dismissed as insignificant the spate of court conversions to Catholicism that occurred in the 1630s, he made Digby an emblem for their frivolity and their meaninglessness. The danger from Rome, he insisted, this is Gardiner, was less serious than it seemed. The bait held out by the papal clergy appealed to the low and more selfish side of human nature. Fantastic speculators like Sir Kenelm Digby, witty intriguers like Walter Montagu, brought no real strength to the cause that they espoused. The arguments by which they had been moved, Gardiner claimed, were repulsive to the sense of honour which was the common property of English gentlemen. Thankfully, subsequent scholarship has taken court conversion more seriously, but Digby has tended to remain on the historiographical fringes to which Gardiner relegated him. In this paper, I will argue that understanding Digby's correspondence is crucial if we are better to understand his conversion and the sophistication of the strategies that characterise his writing more generally, as Noel noted in his introduction. It's in his letters that we see Digby actively shaping and accentuating specific aspects of his beliefs and intellectual undertakings. There's much to be said about Digby's epistolary activities across his career, but I'll focus on his reconversion in the 1630s and the flurry of correspondence that it provoked, particularly with Walter Montagu, the other court convert dismissed by Gardiner as a witty intriguer. I will present the most significant new piece of evidence that I've encountered in my research so far, a lengthy letter from Digby to Montagu in 1636, offering advice on how best to justify his conversion in the face of criticisms from his father. By discussing this, as far as I can tell, previously unknown letter in detail, I hope to achieve three things. To offer the first sustained consideration of Digby's correspondence and its significance. To consider the role played by the exchange of letters amidst the court conversions of the 1630s, and to consider the implications of Digby's particular correspondence for the ways in which we might think about the role and nature of letters in the 17th century more broadly. Before moving on to the specifics of his reconversion, though, I want to accentuate now two aspects of Digby's correspondence, which are on the one hand highly traditional and common to many letters from the period, but which I want to argue he puts to distinctive and telling use. And I want to talk about these under the titles of intimacy and contingency. And the first two quotations on the handout are designed to exemplify these two things. On the 11th of July 1642, Digby sent the latest in a long series of letters to James Cranfield, son of the Earl of Middlesex, and began with a reminiscence. "I saw Sir Toby Matthew once," he wrote, "stay my Lord of Dorset's coach when he was going in the street with some haste. And he came then to my Lord with a face of much business, which, having raised a great expectation of something of weight, all he said was, the calling half a dozen lusty oaths to witness, that he was more his lordship's servant than any man living. And with that he made his leg and went his ways." This rather pointless and ostentatious act of public respect becomes the model for Digby's own address to Cranfield. "I shall do much like that," he said now in this letter. The year before, Digby had entered into a separate correspondence with the man responsible for this abrupt greeting, Toby Matthew, son of the Archbishop of York and friend of Francis Bacon, translator of Francis Bacon, in fact, into Italian, who had infamously gone over to Rome in 1607. Digby and Matthew had both left England at the command of the Long Parliament, having been named repeatedly, along with Montague, as ringleaders of, quote, "the popish faction that labour lustily for the advancement of popery," to quote the confession of the disaffected Jesuit John Brown. The longest of Digby's letters sent to Matthew, dated August 29, 1641, and sent from Spain, is a long, remarkably long list of the various beautiful women on display at the Spanish court. Before he begins this slightly tedious catalogue, however, Digby draws attention to the tenuousness of the very attempt to enter into correspondence with Matthew, the inevitable risk that a letter might go awry and fail to reach its intended recipient. This letter begins, this is number two, "I have observed in such letters as I have written from Greece, Africa, and other remotest parts of the world to my friends in the country, that their hazard and slowness of going to the proportion of the distance from Alexandria or Tripoli to London had not been so great as that little fag end of their way from thence to Oxford, for example. Now here I learned that tutto il mondo è paese, all places fare alike, and have a report of one another. The negligence of a drunken carrier there, and the hazards of his greasy pouch, are here balanced with the docidness of starved water bearers and their torn wallets." So as I've said, I'm beginning with this pair of letters because they exemplify, I think, in particularly forceful fashion, these two very common characteristics of early modern correspondence, which are identifiable features of the Ars Dictaminis as it was developed by the early generations of Italian and Northern European humanists in what recent scholars have recognised as a mixture of revived classical ideals, the continuation of medieval strategies, and genuine novelty. The letter to Cranfield encapsulates the way in which a letter was supposed to replicate both direct conversational address and the physical presence of the sender. This was emphasised already in the writings of Seneca, Cicero and Petrarch, but given influential formulation by Erasmus, as Judith Rice Henderson and Lisa Jardine in particular have emphasised. The latter, as Jardine notes, that, quote, "the qualities Erasmus highlights, as particularly those of the epistola, are the making present of absent persons in living form, the communication of feeling and relationship publicly, but in the language of intimacy." Digby creates this intimate presence by aiming to make his letter as abrupt, surprising, and charming in its subversion of expectation as Matthew's showy interruption of the Earl of Dorset. And he too, he implies, will send mere greetings in this letter when weightier matters might have been expected. If the letter to Cranfield suggests this aspiration of the letter writer to direct verbal address and physical presence, then the letter to Matthew captures an equally prominent, but I think less frequently discussed aspect of early modern correspondence, a heavy emphasis upon the fragility and contingency of the letter, its reliance upon safe passage and its vulnerability to loss, interception, and destruction. To write and send a letter, then, in this humanist tradition is to aspire to direct conversational address, while acknowledging that the exchange is in fact far more tenuous and prone to collapse due to the vicissitudes of fortune than an actual conversation. And as I'm suggesting, this is established as something that Digby puts to new ends. By beginning the letter to Matthew with a recollection of his earlier escapades, these are some of the places that he visited on his Mediterranean voyage, Digby suggests unbroken continuity and close affinity between the travels that he now undertakes in the early 1640s, his enforced exile, and the adventures in the late 1620s through which he originally redeemed his reputation in the public eye. The man who writes now from Madrid is the same man who previously wrote from Greece, Africa, and other remotest parts of the world. The stress that Digby places on the tenuousness of the letter form and its vulnerability to the vicissitudes of fortune is something on which he not only placed unusually strong emphasis, but something that he imbued with recollection of his own distinctive and unusual adventures. In showing some of the ways in which Digby puts these traditional aspects of early modern correspondence to particularly subtle and telling use, my paper today has two other aims, as I've said, although I can't count them as three or four, sorry. The first is present some of my findings, and particularly this letter to Montague, and the role of this letter in the context of court conversion in the 1630s. And then I want to suggest not only that Digby's letters merit further consideration and that an edition of his letters will be a valuable resource for scholars of 17th century history, but that his letters raise a series of significant questions regarding the very nature of early modern correspondence. His letters will vary widely, both in terms of the topics that they address, from personal letters of love and grief, letters on naval affairs, religious controversy, political and diplomatic writings, exchanges on alchemy, natural philosophy and mathematics, but also in the forms that we encounter them in manuscripts, in scribal copies and letterbooks, and some that survive only in various kinds of print. A responsible edition of Digby's letters, I want to suggest, will need to keep alive rather than glossing over these differences and their implications, in order to accentuate the fundamental questions which his correspondence raises, not least, what counts as a letter? Which writings would merit an inclusion as part of this individual's correspondence, and which would not? Can we talk meaningfully of letters as public or private documents and determine the readership for which they were intended, or at least the possible readerships that were anticipated? And I'm going to have two sections, the first of which discusses these issues in relation to the letter to Montague, and secondly, by discussing some of his better-known correspondence, the exchange of letters with his kinsman George Digby in 1638, that was eventually published in 1651. So now the first section proper. Digby seems to have announced his reconversion to two men. John Cook, the Secretary of State, who had served as his mentor during his years as a chief officer of the Navy and Archbishop Laud. I won't talk about his letters to Cook today, although there is actually a lot to say about them. But I want to say a little bit by way of introducing the correspondence with Montague about the letter from Laud. Digby's friendship with Laud flourished in the early 1630s, and it was on the Archbishop's suggestion that Digby donated the magnificent set of manuscripts that he had inherited from Thomas Allen, his tutor at Gloucester Hall, as well as the Arabic manuscripts that he had collected on his travels to the Bodleian. The letter to Laud in which Digby announced his conversion has unfortunately not survived, but Laud's reply, dated March 27th, 1636, has and was printed in the 1695 edition of Laud's Trials. And it offers important insights into the ways in which he confronted the proliferating defections to Rome in this decade. His tone is markedly respectful, even deferential, and his professions of continuing and unbroken affection for Digby are effusive. Laud states that, quote, this is on the handout, "The whole frame of your letter, setting aside that I cannot concur in judgment, is full of discretion and temper, and so like yourself that I cannot but love even that which I dislike in it. And though I shall never be other than I have been to the worth of Sir Kenelm Digby, yet most heartily sorry I am that a man whose discourse did so much content me should thus slide away from me." Laud partly activates here the trope that I've just suggested of the letter providing a surrogate for the presence of its author. I suggest there's a sort of double meaning there in the notion that not only is Digby like himself in the letter, but in a sense the letter is like himself. And he finds himself loving the letter as if it were Digby. These professions of continuing friendship are, however, balanced by criticisms of Digby's justification of his conversion that shed interesting light on his motivations, which it seems, at least in the version he presented to Laud, went beyond mere self-serving ambition. Laud writes that, "First you say, you now perceive that you may preserve yourself in that church without having your belief bound up in several particulars, the dislike whereof had been a motive to you to free yourself from the jurisdiction which you perceived it imposed them." So this notion that the Catholic Church would not bind a believer to as many particulars was not unique as a motive for defections of this sort. In the previous decade, Laud's godson, William Chillingworth, had converted for very similar reasons, believing that he would have greater freedom of conscience and discretion as a Catholic, but was swiftly disabused of this notion by his experiences at Douay. We will see later that Digby's correspondence was written in part with a keen awareness of Chillingworth and his circle. Unlike Chillingworth, though, this would be Digby's final conversion, and Laud's letter allows us to glimpse the terms in which he justified it. Laud's letter also, though, placed great emphasis on the secrecy of Digby's decision and of their correspondence. He writes that he has told Cook of it, and that, and this is on the handout, "to my secretary I must needs trust it, having not time to write it again out of my scribbled copy, but I dare trust the secrecy in which I have bound him." The postscript asks Digby to, quote, look upon all the trust that ever you mean to carry with me, that you show it not, nor deliver any copy to any man. Now, of course, it's always difficult to know precisely how to interpret claims of this sort, whether they should be understood as genuine pleas for secrecy, or perhaps that, but also ways of emphasising the intimacy of the discourse and correspondence that's taking place, perhaps even as something permitted to permit deniability if the letter were to be discovered, given that they were never meant for others' eyes. And I'm going to come back a bit later on to the question of how we think about these implied readerships. It would certainly have been held against Lord if his profession of continued affection for Digby had fallen into the wrong hands, but this doesn't guarantee that this is the only way that the plea for secrecy can be read. The spate of prominent Catholic conversions that took place in England in the 1630s, I would argue, occurred in large part in an ambiguous hinterland of this sort between the public and the private, the intimate and the overt, that the form and conventions of the letter partly made possible. This was true of Digby's reconversion and of others in the circles surrounding Henrietta Maria. As the scholarship of Caroline Hibbard, Anthony Milton, and Michael Questier has shown, the relentless insistence that Popish plots were afoot in court circles cannot be dismissed as mere Puritan paranoia, nor can the Puritan accusation that the Laudian programme amounted to crypto-popery be rejected as a willful or genuine error. A set of increasingly complex and subtle views of the English Church and its relations with Rome had developed throughout the first decade of Charles's reign, which often involved a sharp departure from Jacobean forms of anti-popery. Lord, while denouncing papists and Jesuits, maintained close contact with many of their number, notably the Benedictine Leander Jones, with whom he met several times in 1634-5. While the openly Catholic Queen, much more vocal and assertive in her religion after the death of Buckingham, gathered courtiers and the wise of courtiers around her who displayed strong inclinations towards Catholic forms of worship. It also needs to be recognised that the changes in England seemed like a potential movement back towards Rome, not only to hostile Puritans, but from the viewpoint of the Vatican as well. In 1633, hopes were aired there that both Lord and the King himself might be opened to conversion and to the reintegration of the English Church. This was certainly a misinterpretation of the English scene, but such hopes were fuelled by the increasing number of prominent conversions that did occur. The slow stream of converts from the late 1620s, notably Elizabeth Carey, Lady Falkland, and somewhat earlier the Countess of Buckingham, threatened to become a deluge. Digby's reconversion was among the more prominent, and so too was that of the man with whom, as I've already suggested, he was persistently paired, his friend Walter Montagu. Like his elder fellow convert Toby Matthew, who was, as I said, son of the Archbishop of York, but unlike Digby, Montagu came from a prominent and staunchly Protestant family. His father was the tough and uncompromising Earl of Manchester, who had been Lord Privy Seal and a stalwart member of the Privy Council since 1628. He, that's Walter Montagu, was received by the Queen's chaplain around Easter 1635 after returning from travels to Paris and Rome, and not, it seems, actually in Paris, as has previously been suggested. At the end of 1635, almost contemporaneously with Digby's letters to Lord and Cook, Montagu wrote to his father from Paris announcing and justifying his decision to convert. Manchester was deeply hurt, seemingly as much by his son's failure to consult or forewarn him as by the decision itself, and refused to see Montagu or support his return to court, but instead addressed a letter to him. Both Montagu's and Manchester's letters were copied and circulated widely at court, various copies of both survived. And they drew a response from Lucius Carey, Viscount Falkland, with the three letters eventually published together in 1641. Falkland's mother also wrote a response to her son's letter, now lost. Digby's friendship with Montagu is well known and was frequently commented upon by hostile contemporaries. In 1637, they visited the possessed nuns at Loudun together, an experience about which Digby wrote somewhat sceptically to Hobbes, to whom he sent several letters that year. I have, however, encountered a new piece of evidence that sheds much more detailed light on their relationship at this point. A lengthy letter from Digby to Montagu, dated the 18th of September 1636, now in the Houghton Library at Harvard. Almost 7,000 words long, it offers new insights into the ways in which letters circulated and were read in this period, and the role that they played in the management and defence of acts of conversion. The very opening of Digby's letter is among its most revealing aspects. He begins, and this is number 5 of the handout, "Upon Tuesday last, I wrote unto you to let you know I could not meet with a copy of my lord your father's answer unto you. But now, even this very day, my lord of Chalcedon hath given me the note which he extracted out of that he sent you, which he saith are all the substantial points concerning controversies that are comprised in the letter." This is of interest firstly because it offers a glimpse of the precise and varied forms in which Montague's letter and his father's response to it circulated. In the absence of a copy of the letter in its entirety, Digby was able to ascertain its gist from notes of the crucial points that might be extracted from it. So this, then, is one way that that Magister's letter to Montague might be read, effectively removing it from the conditions of its original circulation and treating its content as separable from its particular mode of address. Digby also writes on this same page, "If I remember your letter well, for I have not a copy of it by me, my Lord of Castledon had that which I took." So what's occurred here, then, is a form of swap in which Digby received the summary of Magister's objections to his son and gave in return his copy of Montague's letter, the two circulating as parts of an incomplete whole, not to be read side by side, unlike the combined form in which they would eventually be published. It's also interesting that the person with whom he made this exchange was none other than Richard Smith, Bishop of Chalcedon, then living in exile in Paris, having resigned his responsibility for the English Catholic community due to intense internal discord and controversy. This allows us to place Digby in closer connection with strongly Gallican elements of the secular clergy soon after his conversion at an earlier stage than any of his other writings have suggested, and several of his theological writings from this stage in his life, I think, would merit reconsideration in light of this context. After making clear the distilled and excerpted form in which he has encountered Magister's response to Montague, Digby requests that, and this is number six, "I pray you accept nothing, expect nothing orderly, composed or digested, for I will write just as conceptions come unto me upon reading the abstract of the answer, line by line as it lieth before me. And how confusedly soever that prove, if it serve to stir up any considerations that you will make better use of, it is all I aim at." This kind of disclaimer is, of course, again, a fairly standard one, another form of humility functioning as a built-in disclaimer whose sincerity is hard to gauge. And Digby was unusually consistent in marking his letters in this way. But I'd also suggest it's particularly consistent with his start as a convert from this point on in his writings. The letter, in its ability to stand in for the presence of the person, combines forceful intimacy and presence with a sense of the provisional and the occasional, allowing Digby to foreground and proclaim his individual consistency, but to do so in a form that permits deniability and is subject to retrospective revision, alteration, and perfection should the occasion call for it. Having framed his letter in this fashion, Digby then goes on to engage in detail with Magister's objections. In his original letter to his father, Montague claimed that he was led towards conversion when, in trying to determine whether Luther could be proved to be the innovator of the Protestants' faith, he endeavoured, quote, to find out an existence of some professors of the Reformed doctrine before Luther's time. In doing so, he claimed, I could find no ancienter a dissension from the Roman Church than Waldo, Wycliffe, and Hus. There's nothing new about this claim, as we all know. The question, where was your church before Luther, had long been thrown at reformers by their Catholic opponents. Magister, writing in response, set little weight on the perpetuation of the church by heresies, and instead placed concerted pressure on the criterion by which the visibility of the church is judged. He observes that, quote, visibility doth not always carry the same height, but admits of degrees. And he goes on to interrogate in trenchant fashion the very notion of uninterrupted succession which Montague had claimed as the prerogative of the Roman Church. Magister makes what I think is the quite subtle claim that, quote, it may be a true church that hath not this uninterrupted succession, for else no church at all could be true in her first plantation, for successions are by descent, descents having no place in first originals. The foundation of a church, Magister claims, is necessarily an interruption and a form of innovation. As a temporal institution, the church begins necessarily with discontinuity, even if its foundation is deemed apostolic. And this means that the ideal of uninterrupted visibility that Montague holds up is a chimera. When Digby sets out to answer Magister's objection, he responds to this point with what is, in some ways, a much less subtle understanding of tradition and its operations than his opponent. In fact, his response seems almost calculatedly naive and ingenuous, proceeding as if the concept of tradition had never been placed under the serious scrutiny that it had received in recent theological debate. Digby sets out to prove a little more particularly, this is quoting him now, the necessity of a constant uninterrupted succession of a visible church planted by Christ and continuing in all ages without any changes of doctrine in the least point. And when this ground is well established, he claims, all the rest is ended, all other petty objections fall to the earth. He He begins by imagining the apostolic promulgation of Christ's teachings proceeding according to God's plans in what he says must be the easiest, fittest, and convenientest way. In this earliest age of the church, faith was propagated by hearing, he says, each man, quote, receiving it from hand to hand. This process can occur, Digby claims, through exact repetition without any alteration or loss of truth. This is number 7 on the handout. In this course, no ignorance can excuse, nor no wisdom or learning can plead exemption. For he that delivereth over teacheth what another taught him, and here in the telling of another's words, it is no matter whether the relator be learned or simple, it is enough to be veridical. He anticipates the charge that due to human frailty, everyone in particular, he says, may swerve from the truth, then why not all? But let us take a particular and exact survey of the matter, he claims, and we shall find this objection can have no room here. And I apologise for the length of the next quotation, but I felt it was important to get the whole argument out there. So this is his argument for the simplicity and ease with which tradition can be perpetuated. The apostles taught what Christ told them by preaching every one of them the same thing as often over and over to the people, and by private conferences and discourses with the most capable, whom God disposed to be most affectionate and attentive to their doctrine, as having a belief it was of all things in the world of greatest importance, as on which the eternal good of themselves and posterity depended. Every apostle did this within the precincts allotted to his preaching, in every town and village, that all men might be instructed. And the matter delivered was such as might be apprehended and remembered, being plainly told, by any person of ordinary good capacity. Now suppose that as soon as any of the apostles should be dead or gone out of his diocese, there should arise among some of his flock some doubt about something taught him, or concerning the right understanding of something left in writing by him. What were the right way to clear it? Surely, if a convenient number of the honestest and wisest men within all that precinct should be called together from the several parts of the country, and being asked not what they in their own wits thought of the matter, but what they had heard the apostle teach, they should all readily agree in saying peremptorily one thing. He were a most unreasonable and most envious man that should not sit down and acquiesce to this testimony. In like manner, if another question should arise in the next age, after all these men were dead that heard the apostles preach, when as many of their children and posterity should come together and constantly aver, this our fathers told us that the apostle preached to them as Christ's doctrine, the question were likewise then at an end. And thus you may drive on the argument from age to age until you come to the present. The guilelessness of this conception of tradition is jaw-dropping, but not, I would suggest, unthinkingly so. According to Digby's account, that the dishonest or inadvertent corruption of doctrine is not only avoidable, it should effectively be impossible. The inherent simplicity of true doctrine, the fact that its meaning is available to any person of ordinary good capacity, makes it, he insists, easy to transmit and retransmit without loss or alteration. If doubts should arrive, then the convenientest number of the honestest and wisest men will readily agree in saying peremptorily one thing. Consensus will emerge naturally from consultation, and this is a process that can be repeated without any loss or mitigation of doctrinal purity down to the present day. On this account, the deep divisions, disputes, and controversies that have riven the church and that were exploding around Digby as he wrote this letter, the Spanish army incidentally was closing in on Paris when this was written, fade out of the picture altogether. They're mere accidents, and it's easy, he claims, to distinguish this unreasonable and envious cavilling from the simplicity with which true tradition is perpetuated. I want to suggest, though, that the straightforwardness of the transmission that Digby proclaims as the basis of tradition is not naive, but in fact the account is closely connected to the form of the letter in which it's delivered. The letter to Montagu does not only describe this straightforward model of tradition, but embodies and perpetuates it. The framing of the letter as the disorganised and spontaneous outpourings of Digby's mind that I quoted earlier renders it, in the tradition leading back to Seneca, Demetrius and Erasmus, close to the immediacy of conversational speech. The letters exchanged between learned friends who aid and buttress one another's decisions to convert recapitulates the private conferences and discourses with the most capable, whom God disposed to be most affectionate and attentive to their doctrine, which, as I've just quoted from the letter, Digby held responsible for the transmission of tradition. In this way, the tenuousness and contingency of letters, the ill formation of the thoughts that they can contain, and the lurking possibility that they might go astray and fail to arrive, does not weaken them, but imbues them with the same sort of freshness and simplicity that ensures the survival of doctrinal tradition. The simultaneous spontaneity and intimacy of the letter form not only allows the convert to assert the continuity of his true self despite his change of religion, as Digby did elsewhere in his letters, The flexible correspondence network that he established with fellow converts such as Montague and Matthew allowed them to perform as well as endorse the Catholic account of uninterrupted tradition that they had embraced. Digby refers in this letter to the delivery over from hand to hand of their faith, which we call tradition. It's a mode of transmission which resembles very much the writing and the circulation of letters. Okay, section two. The latter half of Digby's letter to Montague undertakes this rehearsal of church tradition in the more ostentatious fashion. He claims near the start that Protestants, quote, row laboursomely against the current of antiquity, tradition, succession, fathers, doctors, and the consent of the whole church spread all over the world, containing in it a multitude of wise, learned, and holy men. The latter half of the letter is comprised mainly of quotation from and discussion of one of these men in particular, St. Augustine. Augustine appeared briefly in Montague's letter to his father as an authority on the continuity of tradition and was referred to by both Manchester and by Falkland in their letters of response. Digby, though, goes much further, studding his letter with extensive citation from and commentary on an impressive range of Augustine's works, particularly De Moribus Ecclesiae and Contra Epistula Fundamenti. This is significant in part because it allows us to date the beginning of Digby's engagement with patristic material quite precisely. He tells Montague that he could continue quoting Augustine at will, quote, my chief present study being to read him. And this provides a new background against which to interpret his better known theological writings and discussions slightly later, from the year 1638. That year, a new edition of Toby Matthews' full translation of Augustine's Confessions appeared in Paris, having originally been published in 1620, with an anonymous note to the reader, which we know was written by Digby. And again, the fact that Digby was engaging with Augustine in 1638 is the kind of earliest evidence of his interest in this material. And again, this letter fills that in a lot more fully. It was also in 1638 that Digby began a series of discussions concerning religion with his kinsman George Digby, son of the Earl of Bristol. They continued this exchange by letter, having apparently begun it in an alcove in the church of Saint Germain, he mentions in one of his letters. In the autumn of that year, and their correspondence came to focus in particular on the authority of the Church Fathers and the extent to which patristic writings constituted a coherent tradition upon which the contemporary Church might draw. This exchange was eventually published in 1651, and it crops up moderately frequently in writings about religious debate in this time, but I want to speak in a little more detail about the forms in which this text existed and was read, rather than focusing solely on its final printed version. The printed edition consists of four letters, the first of which is from George to Kennell. I'm going to start using their first names now because Digby gets confusing. Followed by Kennell's reply of December 29th. Sorry, so the first letter is November 38th. Kennell's reply December 29th with an edition penned and dated, slightly confusingly, December 26th. And these three letters make up the first 22 pages of the printed work. This is then followed by George Digby's final response, dated March 30th, 1639, only the fourth and final piece in the correspondence runs to the remaining 109 pages of the printed version. Copies of the first three letters survive, and there are also two extant scribal copies of the entire correspondence, both in Oxford, one in the Bodleian and one in the Library of Worcester. Now, I don't know, I'd be very interested to hear anything this reminds anybody of, because I haven't been able to find another work of quite this sort, the form of which seems to be poised between a correspondence and a treatise, or rather one which begins as a correspondence and then seems to spawn a treatise, which is nonetheless in some ways, as I'm going to discuss, inseparable from the exchange of letters that prompted and inspired it. I'm only going to consider the content of the letters relatively briefly, as it's their form and the extent to which they can meaningly be considered letters that I want to focus upon. In the most general terms, George Digby draws attention to the insufficiency of the fathers as unimpeachable authorities for doctrine or practice, emphasising their dogmatism, their support for blatantly unacceptable theological positions, and the conflicts between them. Kennell insists that his younger kinsman must, quote, read not the fathers with a forelaid design to unnerve their authority, insisting that they can be reconciled and serve as enduring authorities for the church. Jean-Louis Quentin has briefly discussed this work in his magisterial survey of patristic study in 17th century England, in early modern England, convincingly placing it in the context of the sceptical accounts of the church fathers' authority undertaken by the Great Two Circle, There's been some disagreement regarding the possibility that Kenelm Digby himself was a participant in discussions in Great Tew, but this is perhaps the wrong question, especially if we acknowledge that the idea, as recent scholarship has emphasised, the extent to which the Great Tew Circle was in fact a stable and coherent one, has been called into question. But this particular exchange of letters suggests the speed with which the discussions emerging from Tew became, even for those with tenuous connections to the circle, a model of sort both for the content but also for the conduct of religious dispute. Chillingworth is cited by Kenelm, and George's letter provides one of the earliest discussions of Jean Daillé's work in England. His early interest would later be noted alongside Falkland's by Thomas Smith in his preface to the 1651 translation of Daillé. As I've already noted, both Falkland and his mother wrote responses to Montague's letter and were closely involved in the disputes surrounding Catholic conversion in these years. In fact, the parallels between the experiences of Digby and Lady Falkland were remarkable. On the very same day, May the 25th, 1636, so very soon after Digby's correspondence became a matter of public conversion became a matter of public knowledge, both were brought before the Court of Star Chamber to answer the identical charge of sending two of their sons into foreign parts to be educated, as is conceived in the Roman religion. That's from Star Chamber proceedings. And a decade later, Digby would fulsomely praise Lady Falkland's piety in a letter to Pope Innocent X. The long piece of writing from George Digby that completes the exchange in the scribal and print versions of this correspondence displays an impressive range of patristic knowledge for a young layman and was recognised as such at the time. Following its print publication, the correspondence as a whole was praised as a work that could be read with profit against popery, but there was uncertainty as to how it should be described. Clarendon called it a discourse against popery, while, as Nick Hardy has helpfully pointed out to me, the work was praised by the compiler of a library for young scholars in the mid-1650s, probably Thomas Barlow or Richard Baxter, as testimony to both to the uncertainty of the father's judgment, where it's recommended alongside Daillé's work, and as a work to be read against the papists alongside Chillingworth and Falkland. So again, we can see it being linked up in these ways in the 1650s, and it's interesting that it's recommended for both of those reasons. And in both instances, it's referred to by the compiler of this catalogue as the Lord Digby's letter to Sir Kenelm Digby, so it's much more emphatic on its epistolary form. Are we right, then, to consider this 110-page thing as a letter? To put the question in more practical terms, should a document of more than 100 pages in length that may never have been sent be included in an edition of an individual's correspondence simply because it begins and ends in epistolary fashion? Modern editors have differed on this question of what to include and exclude from correspondence, but it's worth noting that it's a problem with a much longer history. In his treatise De Eloquitione, made particularly well known in the Renaissance thanks to Lipsius's translation and publication of part of it in his own writings on epistolary form, Demetrius wrote that, quote, "The length of a letter, no less than its style, must be carefully regulated. Those that are too long and further are rather stilted in expression and not in sober truth letters, but treatises with the heading, My Dear So-and-so." So that's quite interesting. We've got this already there. There's this attempt to make this distinction. And it's also, and obviously it's a very practical question as well. While I generally agree that writings should not be included as correspondence if they only superficially take the form of a letter, and this is true of others of Digby's writings, such as his remarks on Brown's Religio Medici, which is framed as a letter to the Earl of Dorset, I do think an exception would have to be made in this particular case, and that an edition of Digby's correspondence should include this exchange in its entirety, rather than excluding the final letter based solely upon its length. And this is both to do with the way the exchange is constructed and presented, and the way that it was circulated and read in the 17th century. As I've observed, the letters circulated both in scribal copy and then were published in 1651. But I'd say the claim by Clarendon and by the compiler of the Library for Young Scholars that this work was fundamentally a treatise against popery is probably actually a reduction of the complex range of ways in which it could be read in at the moment of its publication. And it's a range that is inseparable from the framing of its ideas precisely as an exchange of letters between these two men. Here, in these letters too, that the traditional assertion of intimacy is extremely conspicuous. George tells Kenelm, quote, "I think of myself as happy to bear the name of your friend and promise to myself as much eternity by the relation as he who engraves Sir Philip Sidney's friendship on his monument." K- Kenelm, in a manner that is, as I've suggested, characteristic of his correspondence to an unusual and significant degree, stresses the particular scene in which the letters were composed and their fragility, the manifold factors that might interrupt a letter's writing or lead it to go astray. And I've quoted this at number 9, this is a vintage DB. His reply, he explains, has been delayed by, quote, my unsteady abode in the town and frequent sudden excursions out of it at late. So sudden and distracted an hour as I have now to write it, he insists, would deter me from offering it any return to so obliging and judicious a letter till I had a greater freedom of both time and thoughts. He goes even further in the addition that he writes to his original response, claiming that he intended to review and copy it before sending it. It should not have been with my dull head and hand and after supper's work, and after coming home from vain entertainment with some impertinent she-wits that most tyrannically had seized upon. As Harold Love has argued, it becomes extremely difficult in the case of scribal publication to determine the division between the public and the private, given that, as I argued in the case of Law's letter to Digby, the very insistence that a work remains private can be read on the one hand as genuine or as a device of some sort to increase an imagined reader's pleasure at achieving a glimpse into an intimate realm. The fiction was usually maintained that the letter was a personal communication between gentlemen, Love notes. Of course, it's hard to tell by how fictional that is, he wrote it at the time. But it's telling, I think, that when Ben Jonson wrote an epigram to my muse, the Lady Digby, on her husband Sir Kenelm Digby in the early 1630s, he included the lines, this is number 10, oh, what a fame 'twill be, what reputation to my lines and me, when he shall read them at the treasurer's board. Then what copies shall be had, what transcripts begged, how cried up and how glad wilt thou be, muse, when this shall then befall. Being sent to one, they will be read of all. This is, on the one hand, a general description, this is how Love quotes it, of the way in which text circulated. And it's an unusually frank and explicit instance of the ways in which many texts, even those that claim to be private and intimate, might anticipate their own subsequent dissemination. But Jonson's lines also suggest that while any manuscript in this period exists somewhere on this spectrum between the fully private and the at least potentially public, those addressed to Digby lean strongly towards the at least potentially public. One writes to him with a particularly strong sense that the epigrammal letter may well see the light of day. In this context, I think, it's far from incidental that the correspondence between Kenelm and George Digby began as and remained an exchange of letters, emphatically marked by the language of both intimacy and fragility. As they circulated in scribal copies, the original exchange of letters did not only, as the later sentiments by Clarendon and Barlow suggest, function as a mere prologue to the long discourse against popery, which is in a sense the main event. They also stood as a model of intimate and occasional exchange between two learned noblemen, an exchange marked by significant disagreement, but also by mutual expressions of love and respect, and a sense of the particular, refined world from which this exchange issued. Recognising the importance of these letters qua letters also allows us to reconsider the relationship between their scribal publication and circulation and the published form in which they eventually emerged, for the two were significantly different. Just as what it meant to read an exchange between George and Kenelm Digby changed significantly between 1638 and 1651. And it's important here, I think, that the publisher of the letters in 1651 was Humphrey Moseley, who, as Lois Potter says, was not only the most prestigious literary publisher of the time, but, I'm quoting her now, firmly royalist throughout his career, he consistently advertised the fact in the prefaces to his publications. His preface to the letters acknowledged that they had been circulating in other forms, and claims that the printed version is definitive. The false copies, as he calls them, imperfect and mangled, must not be allowed, because, quote, in matters of religion, there ought to be greatest care to publish nothing but what is genuine. As a publication on matters of religion, however, the work is somewhat anomalous on Moseley's list for these years. It fits much better as precisely a work of royalist nostalgia, of wistfulness for a time in which religious difference between kinsmen and noblemen might be debated in a loving, respectful, and ironic fashion, just as publications from the Circle of Great Chew were also appearing in the 1650s. Kenelm Digby's name appeared frequently in publications from this period that created nostalgic royalist worlds of this sort. In The Academy of Eloquence, a book of commonplaces gathered by Thomas Blunt and also published by Moseley in 1654, Digby was quoted as saying that, quote, speech is nothing else but an expression to another man of the images one hath within himself. It is this sort of frank revelatory expression that the letters enact as a mode of confessional debate. In John Cotgrave's Wit's Interpreter, a miscellany of poems, dialogues, letters, bon mots and pithy sayings published in 1655, the entries in the long section of love songs, drollery and other verses are largely anonymous, with only three attributed to individuals, two to Walter Raleigh, and one beginning Farewell the Gilded Follies to Kenelm Digby. His was a name that sold as a voice of wit and a reminder for a royalist reader of a world that had been lost. If this is true of Kenelm Digby, I also wanted to just note briefly that it's equally true, but in a very different sense, of George. In the years since 1638, he had become, as Potter puts it, a man whose whole life was bound up with intrigue, standing at the centre of the world of ciphers and encoded letters that circulated during the Civil Wars. A series of publications sponsored by Parliament during the 1640s emphasised his nefarious machinations. Two letters of the Lord Digby to the Lord Taaffe, the rebels general in Munster, was advertised as having been, quote, taken in the said general's cabinet, removed from their dark hiding place into the light. While the design to betray Abingdon showed Digby's scheming attempts to win a parliamentary general to the royalist cause. Mosley's 1651 published publication offered instead an image of this man of schemes and ciphers engaged in a learned, frank, pious and civil exchange of letters with his kinsmen. So now I want to move towards concluding. Mosley claimed that his printed version should replace those already in circulation. And we can catch a glimpse of the implications of this claim in a manner that allows me to emphasise in closing the complex and important role of the letter form in the way that the letters concerning religion were both presented and read. When I collated the printed version of the letters with the two extant scribal copies, I discovered only one significant difference. In both the copies of the first three letters that survive in the British Library and in the printed edition, the letter from Kenelm that precedes George's long response ends simply with a discussion of millenarianism and then just a full stop. In the scribal copy in the Library of Worcester, there's an additional final sentence, which reads, "I beseech your lordship present my humble service to the Lord and Lady Bristol and to my Lady Chichester, all the worthy company unto whom with a happy Christmas and New Year." In the copy in the Bodleian, the same sentence is present, but has been scrawled over to the point that it's barely legible, so I couldn't actually have read it had it not been there in the Worcester copy. How much can we read into the lack of this relatively incidental-seeming sentence? Perhaps not very much. It could be that this was in fact the scribal copy that Mosley or someone else involved in the publication used in preparing the published text, and that the lines were struck out in order to indicate that they should be omitted. I don't think that's likely though, because there is one other bit of it that's been crossed out for a reason I can't really determine it, a discussion of Augustine's 17th Sermon on Baptism, which appears in the print version but is equally firmly obliterated. I don't know quite what to make of that. It seems instead then, I would suggest, that the scratching out of the closing sentence provides a small but significant piece of evidence for the continuing interaction and coexistence of scribal and print publication. The owner of the scribal copy, realising that it was absent from the printed edition, might have struck this sentence out, enacting as they read these letters Mosley's claim that print has trumped other imperfect versions. It's actually an attempt, I think, to make the scribal version look more like or treating the print version as the definitive one in relation to which the other one can be corrected. The reader's deletion of this sentence in response to print, if this is what it is, in fact reduced the intimacy, though, of the letter in its scribal form and the emphasis on the particular and contingent circumstances from which the exchange emerged. The extra sentence found in the scribal version is, in fact, the statement from the correspondence that intimates most clearly the particular circle for which the letters were written. It mentions George Digby's father, the Earl of Bristol, and the worthy company present at Sherborne, as well as offering Christmas greetings which emphasise the time it was written. In excising these words in accordance with Mosley's print edition, the reader of the scribal text in fact minimised the very aspects of the exchange, which made it most amenable to reading as a private and intimate correspondence, founded in a time and a place amidst a close circle of family and friends. It could be that this is just an accident in the history of the text circulation, but as I suggested in the paper, it is peculiarly in keeping with the ways in which Digby himself sought to modulate the intimate presence that his letter provided and the fragile circumstances from which they emerged. This was true in the letter to Montague, I suggested, in a manner connected to the model of smooth and unbroken tradition for which he was arguing. It was equally true for the exchange with George Digby, in which polemic and patristic scholarship were framed as ironic and loving exchange. In both cases, though, the particularity of the letter as a form is essential to the manner in which Digby conducted and presented his reconversion.